are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 29th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Christian Piccolini, author of White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement, and How I Got Out. Also on the program, will tomorrow be the day Trump finally becomes president again today? Meanwhile, Chuck Schumer may have finally gotten it, or at least part of it. The Koch brothers, meanwhile, gear up for the next SCOTUS fight and a massive expenditure in 2018. Fitbit, apparently revealing a bit too much about U.S. military bases. The Trump administration supposedly considering a national 5G network because of China. And Trump says the ice caps are setting records. I don't know what that means. Bristol Bay may have just gotten a reprieve from Pebble Mine. And the Trump slump, U.S. tourism down, costing tens of thousands of people their jobs. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is another week. Let me just give you a little bit of a preview of what this week is going to be like. And we should say we are at full staff complement today. Michael is back from his Western sojourn. Jamie, of course, is here. Matt is here. Brendan is busy on the couch doing whatever he does over there. I'm not typing, pretending like he's playing the piano. This week we have the State of the Union address by Donald Trump. Now, most of you have a good sense that the State of the Union is one of total exhaustion and numbness, I think, at this point. But we will still hear from Donald Trump joining us. The plan is right now. Now, look, someone like Judy Gold, who is in demand just about everywhere across the country for various TV and stage and, frankly, theatrical performances, it's very hard to nail down. However, the plan is that she will be in studio, not only helping us narrate rolling commentary on the State of the Union, but also will deliver a response to the State of the Union, and that will happen. We're gonna start tomorrow. We were debating whether or not we should do a show and this, and it just didn't make sense to put out 5 hours of audio tomorrow. Just doesn't. It's too much. It's too much, ladies and gentlemen. So we will be live starting sometime between 8:30 and 8:45 tomorrow evening. And we will go for as long as it takes. And that is a threat. So check it out. Also, do remember that your membership is what makes this show possible. You can become a member today at Join the Majority Report. Somebody asked me about donating. You can do that at Join the Majority Report too. As well, I should say. And also, I should tell you, it is now January 29th. We are officially 16 days away from Valentine's Day. What are you going to get your loved one or just someone that you, I don't know, tolerate and cohabitate with?
Should definitely include that in the card.
I mean,
I tolerate you.
Yes.
My dear.
We've managed to do this.
In a certain sense.
In a certain sense. Now, you guys have heard me talk about MVMT, Movement, right? Those two guys who dropped out of college. They started their own watch company. Look at you. You went to college.
I know. I regret not dropping out every day.
You're just about to start your own company. It's actually true. But it is amazing how quickly this this company has grown. They have sold almost 2 million watches in 160 countries. They continue to revolutionize fashion in the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. They've even doubled their number of watch styles and they're now selling high-quality sunglasses and women's bracelets. So now's the time, folks. Valentine's Day is coming up. Our friends at Movement have put together the perfect interactive gift guide to make Valentine's Day shopping painless. Whether you're shopping for him or whether you're shopping for her, you find everything from watches to fashion-forward bracelets, sunglasses, at MVMT's limited edition gift box. They're all curated by MVMT's in-house stylists with their trendiest pieces that your someone special will love. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to MVMT.com/majority. Go to MVMT.com/majority. Get 15% off. That also comes with free shipping, free returns. Join the movement. All right. So I want to get on that in 1 second. I just want one quick thing from conversations we had over the past couple of days. I get an email, somebody saying, taking me to task for not being as harsh on anarcho-communism as I have been on libertarians. And I don't want to litigate this right now, but we should obviously take more time and maybe do a show to dedicate to this.
I have a quibble, sir.
But let me just say something, the fundamental difference, okay? Without saying any more, the fundamental difference in my mind.
Also, libertarianism, I'm sorry to butt in, it could be right-wing libertarianism or left-wing libertarianism, which is kind of what anarcho-communism is.
Right, that's right. But those concepts, for me, I have the crossover there, I do have problems with those concepts. But I don't want to litigate that now. But the difference is this, and their charge was like, that's just as utopian as libertarianism. Right-wing libertarianism, I guess, from this guy's perspective. And let me just say this. Even if I stipulate that that's true, that they're both utopian, the fact of the matter is that en route to that utopia, depending on which one is very detrimental for society, from my perspective, and one is benefits society. So that is the fundamental difference. We described this the other day. It was like, you know, we're on a bus here. Some people stay on the bus longer than others. Towards that, let's call it, for the sake of just this point, utopian. But there's nothing worse than the libertarian utopia, except for every stop along the way. So that's the fundamental difference. We will have a more in-depth conversation about it, but at a future date.
Well said.
Oh, well, thank you. All right. So with that said, one of the things that is, you know, people have asked me also, why on your Twitter feed do you still have that picture of George Bush in his mission accomplished flight suit? Why do you maintain the George Bush obsession? And part of that, it's just an expression of my age, perhaps. But,
your obsessive personality?
My obsessive personality. But the other thing is that, and Atrios was bemoaning this on Twitter the other day. I think I may have mentioned it. That people seem to have forgotten how bad George Bush was and how what we're seeing today is in no way anachronism in terms of the Republican mind. This stuff has been going on for at least a couple of decades, at least in terms of the insanity involved in the Republican Party. I wrote a book in 2006 with Stephen Sherrill saying that the Republican Party was not your grandpa's Republican Party, that the movement conservatives, that's what was marginal, has now moved to the center of the party and was taking it over. All of this stuff was quite clear then. And part of this came out the other day. There was a poll that said the majority of, I think, Americans, never mind Democrats, have a positive image of George Bush. And somebody said, well, you got to look at the question because it's just, No, I don't care. There's a huge failure, and certainly by the Obama administration and by Obama himself wanting to turn the page, failure in making it clear that George Bush and everything his administration representative was horrific. Hundreds of thousands of lies were needlessly destroyed and wiped out. Civilian lives. Because of George Bush. And this is ongoing. This is ongoing. And of all places to have been reminded of this, here's Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live.
Like I was saying, I don't know if you've seen the news, but according to a new poll, my approval rating is at an all-time high. That's right. Donnie Q. Trump came in and suddenly I'm looking pretty sweet by comparison. At this rate, I might even end up on Mount Rushmore, right next to Washington, Lincoln, and I want to say Kensington. I don't know. But the point is, I'm suddenly popular AF. And a lot of people are saying, man, I wish George W. Bush was still our president right about now. So I just wanted to address my fellow Americans tonight and remind you guys that I was really bad. Like historically not good. So I get why you don't like this current guy. Heck, I voted for Jill Stein all the way. But please do not look back at my presidency and think, this is how we do it. Don't forget, we're still in two different wars that I started. Hey, what has two thumbs and created ISIS? This guy.
There you go.
That was shocking.
Extremely well done.
That was great.
Yeah, that was very big of him.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Christian Pigiolini, author of White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Christian Pigiolini. He is the author of White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. Christian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right. Let's start with your descent into America's Most Violent White Movement, meeting Clark Martell. Who was he, and how did you meet him?
Well, I I think most people think that folks that go down this extremist path come from a broken home or a bad family life. And in fact, that wasn't really my case. My parents are Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s, and they often struggled with prejudice. So it wasn't part of my family DNA. But I felt abandoned by them because they worked so often. They were gone 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. And at that age, I didn't really understand why. I thought I had done something to push them away. So I went in search for acceptance elsewhere. And one day when I was 14 years old, after being marginalized for all those years and being bullied, I was standing in an alley and I was smoking a joint. And a guy pulled up in a Firebird, got out of the car with a shaved head and boots, and the year was 1987, so nobody really knew what a skinhead was in America. And he came up to me, and he pulled the joint from my mouth, and he looked me in the eyes and said, "That's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile." Now, to be honest, at 14, I didn't know what a communist or a Jew or even what the word docile was, but it was as if this man had given me my first lifeline. I was searching for an identity and a community and a purpose. And he was the first one to see my vulnerabilities and then promise me that paradise.
And this is in Illinois, right? At that time?
Southwest side of Chicago, 1987. And in fact, Clark Martel was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader, and America's neo-Nazi skinhead movement had been born in that alley just a few years before.
Wow. Okay. So this was like you just stumbled into sort of their lair as opposed to they're going out and actively sort of like recruiting kids. Because there's a quality of this that is like, it's almost like like Scientology, where, you know, back in my, I don't know, somewhat of my youth, wandering around the streets of Boston, I would get approached by people, you know, Scientologists, and they're like, "You look like you're a little bit lost. Let's see what we can do here." I mean, was there that? Was that the dynamic? A and B, was that when Martel comes up on you? Are you the fifth kid that he had done that to that day? And this was like, you know, Thursdays we go out and recruit type of situation.
Yeah, it's exactly how you're describing it, Sam. It's about these very savvy recruiters who are looking for vulnerable young people, people that they think that are broken or could use, you know, some acceptance. So it's no different if we're talking about Scientology or if we're talking about neo-Nazi skinheads or what we're calling the white nationalist movement now, or even ISIS. You know, people are looking for, and it's something everybody looks for, identity, community, and purpose. And if we have what I call potholes, those things in life that appear in our path that we just can't navigate around, like trauma or abuse, or for me, it was abandonment or even mental illness or joblessness. If we have these things, these potholes that we keep falling in and don't have the right resources to pull ourselves out, sometimes we get detoured down a pretty dark path, and somebody there will accept us. And somebody like Clark Martel or even me later on, when I learned how to recruit, would actively always be looking for vulnerable people who looked like they were broken or didn't have a whole lot, that we could come in and promise that their problems weren't their fault. They were somebody else's fault. It was always about the other. And that's when we would use fear rhetoric and blaming of other people to remove the blame from them. And in fact, most people that I met in the movement were self-haters. They hated themselves so much for their own situations that they were very willing to project that pain and that hatred onto other people so they didn't have to deal with it. I never met a white supremacist with good self-esteem.
That's fascinating. And so when you went on, and I don't want, we're skipping ahead here, but we'll go back and sort of just do the TikTok, I guess. But when you went out and ultimately became that recruiter, were there outward signs that you would look for? Would you have to like saddle up next to someone to get a sense? I mean, how did you know? I mean, I presume you cast a wide net, right? But at one point you start to realize like, oh, I can raise my yield by looking for this sign or that sign. What were those signs?
Well, we would go to places where we knew that vulnerable young people would gather. We would hang out outside of punk rock shows and hand out flyers and look for the kids who didn't look like they had anything. We would go to skate parks. We would go to you know, places where young people who were searching, you know, for inclusion, for an idea of how they could change the world, because young people are idealistic, but they also, you know, are sometimes misguided. And we took advantage of that fact. And it's the same way that now with the internet, that this new metastasis of the movement is targeting people in forums, like gaming forums, where they know that marginalized young people are, ADHD forums and mental health forums, schizophrenia and autism, online gathering places where they know that young people who maybe have been bullied, who might be more susceptible to a certain message that's very black and white, they're actively looking for these you know, kind of broken individuals who they can promise acceptance, they can promise an identity to, and a purpose can be focused. Because in real life, perhaps these people are socially awkward, they're not fitting in, they may be bullied, and they're desperately looking for something. And the ideology and the dogma are not what drive people to this, to extremism. It's, in fact, I think a broken search for that that acceptance and that purpose and community.
It's interesting because, you know, as you say this, I keep thinking about that the documentary Mr. Death, about Fred Leuchter, I guess, who became the darling, I think, of the Holocaust denial, if I remember correctly, movement in Germany, because he had something to do with like gas chambers in this country or gassing people. And he was just like a lonely guy who all of a sudden like had this whole crew of friends that thought he was this great. And it was really all about, you know, nothing to do with ideology as much as it had to do with like, I have a community now.
No, that's absolutely true. And you see that in inner city gangs. You can see that in any kind of social group, even positive ones where people just want to, you know, feel accepted, and they adopt the same look, the same language, you know, the same actions and beliefs as anybody, you know, in that group does as well. It's really about belonging. We all want to be part of something that's bigger than us, and we all want to establish our identity. And sometimes we do that just by assimilating. And some of us may not be strong enough to, you know, to be that individual identity. So we tend to attach ourselves to groups, and those groups become bubbles. And sometimes those bubbles have agendas. Sometimes they're positive, and sometimes they're negative. Sometimes they, even though they are positive, have real trouble communicating with other bubbles. And I think that that's kind of the shape that we're in today.
I want to circle back to some of those things, and particularly about how that applies to gender differences. But let's move forward in the timeline. You're 14 at that time, and then you attend the first meeting of what ultimately would be the Hammerskin Nation. What is the Hammerskin Nation? And also tell us about CASH.
So CASH is an acronym for Chicago Area Skinheads, and that was Clark Martell's group here in Chicago, and that was the first recognized neo-Nazi skinhead group in the U.S. It started in the mid-80s. And by, you know, the time I got in 1987, some small groups and pockets of neo-Nazi skinheads had started to appear across the U.S. in places like Dallas and Milwaukee and Michigan and other places. And the idea sprung up that they wanted to bring all these kind of disparate groups under one umbrella. So the idea of creating this Hammerskin Nation, where each state could have its own Hammerskin chapter, but would roll up into a national organization, kind of took hold. I was at that first meeting where that was being discussed when I was 14 years old, and that was the first meeting that I'd ever been to. And here was a room full of 35 skinheads, you know, much older than me, who, you know, were very angry, who were very focused and militant, you know, who gave fiery speeches and really, you know, instilled this sense of fear that if we didn't do something to protect what we thought was being taken away from us, our white identity, you know, we would lose if we didn't revolt. So, you know, the idea took hold to create kind of this national organization, which ended up becoming still to this day the most violent and deadly skinhead organization in the world.
Was there any, like, did they have any rituals? I mean, did you go through any, like, sort of indoctrination rituals or something like that? Or, I don't know, like blood handshakes or stuff like that?
No, it wasn't anything like that, but it was the sheer sense of the propaganda being repeated over and over and over that was the indoctrination. Part of the ritual was the music. Music was probably the biggest propaganda and recruiting tool that we had. And in fact, I was in two of America's first white power bands and the first to travel overseas to play a concert in Germany in 92. But, you know, music was propaganda. It was education. It was a social networking tool because it brought people from all different parts of the country together for, you know, the very rare occasions that we had concerts because they were very difficult to have. But, you know, you'd have these four or five or six massive festivals where hundreds of people would come in from all over the country and use it as a bonding experience. But there was also a ton of infighting that was fueled by alcohol and insecurity at these concerts. You know, as far as ritual, it was the way we dressed. You know, we all maintained a kind of a uniform identity so that we could be seen. And the music, you know, was kind of the common thread that kept us together the same way that, you know, websites like Stormfront or the Daily Storm or do today for that movement. And nowadays, you know, what's interesting is that the movement is metastasized. 30 years ago, we decided that the skinhead look was too offensive to the white American racists we wanted to recruit. It was turning them off. So we decided to tone it down, throw our hair out and trade in our boots for suits and go to college campuses where young people were forming ideas and looking for communities, even get jobs in law enforcement or go to the military for training and, you know, ultimately run for office. And the scary part is it's become normalized and we cannot see what we used to very easily see. The look is polished. The words are more palatable. It's become part of our mainstream discussion. And that was a strategy to blend in because we knew we needed to be among the people we wanted to recruit.
Talk to me about, and we're skipping a little bit ahead here, but that's fine. Because at 16, Clark Martel, when you were 16, Clark Martel ended up going to jail and you were left to be essentially the leader, I guess, of Cash, right? At that point.
Yeah.
I mean, tell me about those strategies. Like when you started talking, like at what point, so you're in that movement for 8 years. At what point did you guys start to like talk about this idea that our look is becoming an impediment that, you know, that even though this is, sort of our, you know, these are our colors, at what point did you say this is becoming an impediment?
You know, I think in the early 90s, David Duke was probably one of the first people to take off the Klan robe and put on a suit and start to run for office. So I would say, you know, in 1990, 1991, it started to become, you know, the fashion to mature into a more normal look. You saw a lot of people join militia groups you know, adopt kind of that more American militant movement. Some people who were in the Klan started to just drop that whole style of clothing and adopt a more Christian fundamentalist look and viewpoint. And, you know, it certainly has spread over the years. And, you know, we're calling these groups now the alt-right and white nationalists, which, in fact, those are terms that I refuse to use because they're marketing terms that that movement made up to seem, you know, a little bit more respectable and less hateful. But, you know, in fact, there's that common thread of white supremacy and even neo-Nazism throughout all of it. But yeah, it's taken hold over the last three decades, I would say.
Yeah, and I want to return to that in a moment. But one thing, too, that interests me at that time, because that, you know, that era, I was I'm a little bit older than you. So I remember going to shows and, you know, there were mosh pits and there was skinheads, but they weren't necessarily. It started getting confusing at one point because there were also non-fascist skinheads. I mean, just as ideologically non-fascist. What was that dynamic about? I mean, did you run into that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, most people don't know this, but, you know, when we think about skinheads, we tend to think about racist skinheads, when in fact, you know, skinheads didn't start out that way. You know, there are many non-political skinheads and certainly a lot of anti-racist or anti-fascist skinheads, but somehow, you know, through the media, they kind of get lumped in, unfortunately. We fought with anti-racist, anti-fascist skinheads, often white skinheads, more often than we did with minorities. And the dynamic was that, you know, kind of what we're talking about Antifa today, that was, you know, the precursor to that, the, what we used to call anti-racist action or sharp skinheads against racial prejudice, were, you know, really the predecessors to what we're calling the Antifa movement today. It's nothing new. It's something that's been around for a long time. They certainly aren't terrorists like some people are classifying them. I would see them as a resistance to racism and to fascism. But yeah, we, you know, the dynamic was difficult because we often had people go from one side to the other. Sometimes we would, you know, turn people away who would become anti-fascist, and sometimes they would turn people away who would end up coming to our camp. And in many cases, it was still about this broken search for acceptance that drove people to one side or the other.
And so was there something, I mean, and it's just a question of, I guess, how that person's situated as to whether or not they feel like they want to join your skinhead group versus the non-ideological or, you know, or the anti-fascist skinhead group, right? I mean, is it just like, it just happenstance, who gets there first or just, you know, I mean, stuff that...
Sometimes it depends on...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sometimes it depended on their past experience and, you know, maybe how they were raised and who they gravitated to. But it certainly was kind of, you know, this gang fight to, you know, recruit more people. You know, this was already a subculture that was shared based on our looks and sometimes even music. And, you know, it really didn't take much to get one person from one side to the other because everything else was so similar. But ultimately, it was really about... you know, not about ideology or about territory. It was about social groups that were at odds with each other.
And so at one point, you guys get the sort of the notion or the idea starts to come into broadly into your community that we need to be like a clean for Gene type of situation, I guess, and dress up, be more respectable. And you said people went into, did people go into like the military, into the police departments? Specifically to recruit, did they go in there and say like, hey, I'm going to form a beachhead here? Or was it just, this is also sort of consistent with, you know, where we want to head to? I mean, how did that work?
Well, sometimes it was for purposes of recruitment. Sometimes it was for purposes of getting training. You know, certainly going to the military would allow you to get combat skills for a revolution that we were convinced was imminent. Sometimes it was about infiltrating just to be able to change things from the inside. You know, sometimes it was a reaction to wanting to get away from the movement. Certain people would say, I want to go into the military to recruit, but really that was their only opportunity to escape us.
Yeah.
You know, people went through pretty desperate measures, to leave. And oftentimes they stayed in because they weren't strong enough to walk away from the only identity and community that they knew. Because starting over, once you're an open white supremacist, is difficult. Not only are you now faced with these friends that have become your enemies and oftentimes want to hurt you, but society has a hard time accepting that somebody may be able to change. When in fact, we all start out as not racist, and we just kind of get detoured down that path for part of our life and hopefully eventually find our humanity again. So I do believe people can change, but sometimes society just won't accept that. So it's difficult to leave, and sometimes people stay in, even though they question their ideology and denounce it internally, they won't do it publicly because they can't leave that sense of identity and community.
All right. So at one point, and this I found fascinating, and then I want to talk about Johnny Holmes, but you were approached by representatives of Gaddafi. Is that right? Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah. In the early 90s, a fellow Hammerskin from Canada had approached me to try and recruit me to go on a trip where folks from Libya, from Tripoli, wanted us to meet with people from Gaddafi's regime, because he was actively interested in funding groups that were anti-Jewish, anti-Israel in the United States. I declined. I was still too patriotic to want to work with a dictator from a foreign country, especially a non-white country at the time. So I declined, and ultimately it ended up being part of a Canadian intelligence sting where several people went to prison. People like Don Black, who runs the Stormfront Forum for white supremacists, and there was even assumption that David Duke was involved in part of that as well. And some people went to jail.
Wow. What are the chances that that's happening today? Or what are the chances that that's not happening today?
Well, I've been predicting for almost 20 years that what we'll see eventually is, these far-right white supremacist extremist groups actually working with Islamist extremist groups. And while that might seem really odd to the average person because they certainly don't like each other, one thing that they have in common is their common hatred for Jewish people and the Jewish elite. So I think ultimately you will see more instances of far right and Islamist terrorism occurring, whether that's training each other, sharing information, coordinating attacks. I think it's something that we will see in the near future.
All right, let's tell us the story of Johnny Holmes, because this is also, I guess, tells largely the story, or in some respects, the story of you, of you exiting this this movement.
Well, once I finally decided to leave the movement in 1995, I had lost everything around that time. I had closed my record store where I was selling white power music because I had begun to meet people at the store that I'd kept outside of my circle, people who were African-American or Jewish or gay. And suddenly I began to connect with them and humanize them and force the demonization outside of my head. And realized I had more in common with them than I did with the people that I'd surrounded myself with.
Did they know?
I closed the store.
I'm sorry. Did those customers that came in, because you met this wide array of people that you had demonized, did they know that you were a white supremacist and they engage you? Or was it just sort of like, hey, I come in here every Thursday to check out your albums, that type of thing?
They knew it was Chicago is a big city, but it's a small community as well. And I was obviously very, well known for my activities. They absolutely knew, and they came in cautiously, empathetic. And over time they felt more comfortable. And these were the people that I received compassion from when I least deserved it. They were the folks I least deserved it from because, they were my enemy. And they were the people that I had hurt, and they still came in seeing something inside of me that I maybe didn't even see myself, and they, forced their empathy on me, and they didn't have to do that. But anyway, when I pulled the White Power music from the shelves because I was so embarrassed to sell it in front of these new friends, the store had to close. So I lost my livelihood. My wife and my children, had left me because I hadn't left the movement quickly enough, and they weren't a part of it. I didn't have a great relationship with my parents, and I'd walked away from the only community and identity that I'd really known. So I suffered a pretty deep depression for 5 years, and in 1999, a friend came to me very concerned, and she said, I don't want you to die. Please, let's change something. And she encouraged me to go apply for a job where she was working at IBM, and I thought she was nuts. I said, there's no way that a guy with, Nazi tattoos on his body, who'd never gone to college, who was kicked out of 6 different high schools, one of them twice, is ever going to get a job, with a computer company. And by the way, I don't even own a computer. But she, encouraged me to go, and I went, and I ended up getting the job. And I was thrilled because it was the first thing in my life that really seemed to have some forward momentum and meaning. And it was a job setting up the computers and the network at a school district. And I was thrilled until I found out that that school district that I'd be, working at for the next several months was the same high school that I'd been kicked out of twice. As you can imagine, I was terrified. I thought, here I am 5 years out of the movement. I'm trying to build a better life. I'm a better father. I treat people with respect and with tolerance. And I'm just going to lose this thing that has any meaning to me. I'm going to go back to that depression where I wanted to, wake up and wish that I hadn't woken up. And of course, it's karma or destiny or fate would have it. And that first hour, as I'm creeping around the dark hallways, trying to not be seen or recognized, who walks by me but Mr. Johnny Holmes, the older black security guard who I'd gotten in a fist fight with that got me kicked out the second time and dragged out in handcuffs. And he didn't recognize me, but I saw him. And I had never talked about my past. I'd been trying to outrun it for 5 years. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say, but I knew I had to do something. So I followed him to the parking lot and tapped him on the shoulder. And when he recognized me, he took a step back because he was afraid. And all I could think to say to this man who I'd, hurt physically and tormented, was, "I'm sorry." And he stuck out his hand and I shook it and we talked and we embraced and cried a little bit. And he made me promise one thing after forgiving me. He made me promise that I would tell my story. And that story ultimately became the book White American Youth. He changed my life because he let me know that what was killing me inside was the fact that I had been trying to outrun my past. And he also recognized, I think, that it wasn't the story of some, broken kid from a terrible family who went into, a domestic terrorist group. He recognized it was the story or the potential story of every young person who was on a search for identity, community, and purpose and had hit a wall on that search. So I hope, I hope the insight that I give on what drew me in, what life was like in it, and ultimately how compassion helped me out, we'll be able to reach other young people who might be struggling despite, their race, their religion, where they come from in society. I think it's a story that can relate to every young person.
I want to talk a little bit about gender, because you mentioned, in the context of the white supremacist, extremists sort of cleaning up and becoming trying to integrate into society, repackaging themselves as alt-right. And talk about going into the gaming community, and then you start getting into sort of like these overlays of of men's rights activists. And there seems to be a lot of overlay, and there's a lot of like gender politics. I'm curious as to what your perspective is on that. Where people are situated, right? Because there's guys out there who, it seems to me, who are like supposedly who are sending, I'm not claiming that Jordan Peterson is a is a white supremacist, but I just saw some, I was just watching a little bit of YouTube where he was talking about, like, you know, men out there or young men out there are feeling disaffected and need to feel good about themselves and whatnot. And it seems like the same crew of people who are being, who are open to these messages that they're going to give them a self-esteem. And one comes in the form of white supremacy and another comes in the form of, like, gender rehabilitation, or you know, not, I don't think they would say supremacy, but they would say reinvigorated or some, you know, like there's some quality to all of this. Sure. And where are those fault lines? Who feeds into what here, and where is gender in this?
Well, these types of groups are always very good at keying in on what's happening in society to that they can spin to use as fear rhetoric. So when, you know, gay marriage was first coming, you know, on as a national topic, they used that to instill fear, you know, in faith communities that were already, you know, homophobic, saying that it would destroy the ability to, you know, for Christians to thrive and have children. Now they're keying in on the fact that, you know, white men are being called out for horrible acts, and they're using it as the victim narrative. So they are now appealing to, you know, potentially decent white men and through the fear rhetoric that their identity is being taken away by feminists, by, you know, leftists, by transgender and LGBTQ communities. You know, these movements are always very misogynistic. It is about white male dominance, and it's been like that throughout history, really. Where, you know, anybody who's not a white male, you know, is seen as a lesser person. And now, because of all the news that's coming out through Me Too and you know, and women's rights movements, they're using that irrational fear that white men are in danger of losing their identity or losing their power. And, you know, sometimes people get attached to this propaganda and hear it in a way that relates to them somehow, but they don't realize that, you know, this is all through fear rhetoric and conspiracy theory. Nobody's trying to take away, you know, whiteness from anybody or the fact that you're a male. You know, we're just talking about issues that are unjust and bringing them to the fore. Thankfully, sometimes for the first time, and, you know, we're having these discussions, and they're using it to just ramp up the fear. Anytime there's a seed of fear, they are throwing fertilizer on it. So you'll see them shift into different topics all the time, whether it's, you know, anti-Muslim when an attack happens, or pro-white male when, you know, we see women finally getting, you know, equal rights, or at least a platform to talk about the idea of equal rights for women.
Well, so all right, so give me, I'm curious, like, in the context of, you know, one of the messages you have is that, you know, obviously to reach out to these individuals, that there's a chance that all of them, if not some of them, are redeemable and whatnot. From, I mean, what about, like, the leaders and who they are? And you know, and the thought leaders, you know, because, you know, on this program, right, like, I will call out members of the alt-right and, you know, we'll replay videos that we've seen of them, whether it's Richard Spencer or, you know, and I don't know if he's alt-right. I mean, he seems full-on white supremacist Nazi, but maybe even my saying full-on is not appropriate in this context. But guys like Gavin McGinnis and, you know, the guys who wear the Perry tennis shirts, you know, so they can, you know, or even, you know, when you have sort of a more of an intellectual veneer where you're talking about mainstreaming a perspective on Islam, that it is, let's say, the mother load of bad ideas, you know, that type of thing. What should we be doing generally? And what should someone like me, who has a, you know, not a huge platform, but a platform, and should I be exposing these people, or am I driving them, you know, into a corner in some way? What is it? What do you think, because you've obviously been working for at least a decade now on getting people out of these movements, what's the best thing for all of us to be doing?
Well, you know, I can tell you that there are two things that neo-Nazis or white supremacists love, and that's silence and violence. If we're silent, if we refuse to acknowledge that they exist, if we sweep them under the rug and continue to think that we're living in a post-racial society and we're surprised when we hear about, you know, a rally, they grow because, you know, they are able to now focus on the grievances of people and tailor their approach. If we are violent towards them, they grow because they then use that as the victim narrative, the same way that they do the white male narrative. You know, they are now the ones being attacked. They're the ones who are being hated by the haters. They're the ones whose freedom of speech and rights are being, you know, taken away or oppressed. You know, they're very good at spinning information. They're very good then at discrediting the other side and calling them terrorists. And that's why we're hearing, you know, such bad things about Antifa. And the reality is Antifa are not terrorists and they're not violent. While there may be some people in those groups that are violent, there are always, you know, extremes in every organization. The best example of what I saw was actually just a few weeks after the Charlottesville rally in Boston, when you had a couple of dozen white supremacists rally, and around 20,000 people from Boston surrounded them as a counter protest. And they said, you know, we see you, we hold you accountable. We want you to know that we're here, you know, against your message. But we're not going to adopt the same tactics that you do. We're not going to be violent or punch you in the face. We're not, you know, we're not going to throw things at you. And if you want a way out, here's a pathway. We'll take you, because we have to understand that these people joined these movements because they felt marginalized. Things in their life were not going well. And for some reason, they thought that adopting a violent, hateful ideology would make them feel better about themselves. Because if we make people feel worse than we feel, then we feel better. So I think pushing them away is not the right tactic. I believe in bringing them in closer. I've had conversations with Richard Spencer. I sat with him for 2 hours in Whitefish, Montana. I was there speaking after the terrible troll storm and attacks that they received at the hands of the Daily Stormer and even Richard Spencer. The Jewish community there was attacked online. They were threatened. Their addresses and photos and phone numbers were published. Their pictures were photoshopped, at the gates of Auschwitz. Young people, kids of, Jewish families and children of the rabbi were threatened. And the town was terrified. And Richard Spencer lives in Whitefish, Montana with his mother and his daughter about 50% of the time. And the other 50% he lives in Virginia. And I was there. The community invited me to speak, and I spoke there. And knowing it was a place where he lived, I sent him a Twitter message saying, "Hey, I dare you to come to my talk tonight. I'm speaking in your town, and I'm speaking about you." And he replied back saying he would come. And he did come. Nobody saw him walk in to the auditorium because he went up to the balcony and it was dark. And at the end of my talk, somebody had asked in the audience as the last question, you know, obviously our town is known for Richard Spencer. What would you say to him if he were here? And I turned and I took the microphone. I looked up to the balcony and I said, "Richard, would you like to go out for a cup of coffee?" Because, you know, I wanted to listen. I wanted to hear why he went down that path. I'm not interested in hearing his ideology or his beliefs or debating with him, even though we tried. I would always divert by asking him a question, a personal question. What his relationship was like with his father, who also spends 50% of his time away from his family living in Dallas. I asked him, you know, how hard it was to be a father to his daughter, you know, being gone. And those questions caught him off guard. And he gave me what I thought were pretty honest answers that seemed vulnerable. And he admitted that he had, a tough relationship with his father and had a hard time living up to his expectations. Said it was hard to be away from his daughter and not be there for her. So I heard all these potholes that I talked about. And while, I still think that Richard Spencer is, a pompous, self-serving racist, I also know that at some point he was not a monster. At some point, he was a quote-unquote normal person who couldn't deal with something in his life that he chose to go down that dark path to fulfill that need, which is why I believe that everybody can be redeemed. And I approach everybody the same way that I would have liked to have been approached as a teenager. At 18, if somebody would have thrown a bottle at my head, I probably would have punched him back. And it would have made me even angrier. But I approach with compassion and I listen and I look for the things that I can help with and build resilience with. Because once a person feels better about themselves, they often don't need to blame the other for what's wrong in their life. They're now accountable.
So let me ask you this. Without having access to Richard Spencer and clearly... you had that moment, but is there any value, broadly speaking, to playing the clips of him in that I think they had some type of like a meeting at a bar and they were doing karaoke, and mocking those. I mean, for those people who are out there thinking this may be, these guys may be guys we want to join or,
No, I mean, those things, if anything, work in the opposite way. I mean, when I saw skinheads on Oprah Winfrey's show in the mid 80s or, Geraldo getting his nose broken, that made me want to get more involved with those groups. You know, there's a fine line between giving them a platform and for talking about them. I think we need to talk about it. We need to recognize that these things exist, but I also think that we don't need to give them a platform to express their views where they can infect other people with these, with these false messages and conspiracy theories and fear rhetoric. We can't sweep it under the rug. We need to hold it accountable, but we also need to understand that by, ostracizing them, we're pushing them further away. And I can tell you, I've worked with over 100 people that I've helped disengage. And I've worked with people who were born into Klan families who spent their whole lives in them. I've talked to KKK Grand Dragons who I've helped, people in prison who've changed. We can't think that they're all monsters. We have to think that they're just human beings who are broken, who are capable of doing monstrous things. And if we can find them a way back onto that path, I believe we can all do that through compassion and with empathy. We tend to hear the voices on the extremes right now, and they're the loudest, and they're also the fewest. Truth is we're all floating around somewhere in the middle. And if we start our conversations with things that we have in common, the fact that we're Americans or parents, or we have children who we care about and want to see succeed and go to college and be healthy, if we can start our conversations there with people that maybe we disagree with, eventually we'll go off track, but we will have established that connection, that human connection. If we start out on the extremes and start with debate and arguing and calling each other names, and now both sides are calling each other Nazis, we never get to the middle. We never establish that connection.
Well, I mean, because one of the things, one of the strategies, let's say, the U.S. has followed when it comes to ISIS is to denigrate ISIS, to call it Daesh, and to make it less, seem less cool and attractive. I mean, is that the wrong, if there's a similar dynamic, is that the wrong approach?
I don't know if that is, more wrong of an approach than, bombing villages, which is really what's causing extremism, which is really what's causing anger, because extremists are using that fear rhetoric again, saying, the West is just trying to destroy our identity. They're trying to take away our traditions. And the extremists are going to this general public to recruit by instilling these this fear rhetoric. So, you know, maybe if we stopped taking opportunity away from people,
right,
and this isn't just abroad, even in our own country, we'll see less extremism. If we brought more opportunity to the world and to our own communities, then maybe we'll see less people joining gangs. We'll see less people becoming divided based on race or class. You know, if our institutions and our systems weren't heavily favored towards whites and against minorities and people of color, then, you know, perhaps we would be talking about this less and have less of a reason to use slurs and words. But, you know, I would agree. I don't want to use ISIS because that's a term that they came up with, just like white nationalism and the alt-right. You know, we should be calling terrorism what it is. I'm not denying that it exists in many, many forms. But I can also tell you that the biggest terrorism problem that we have is already living within our borders. We already have a white extremist terrorism problem. You know, Timothy McVeigh with the Oklahoma City bombing was one of the only times we've actually called it out as terrorism, but we didn't connect the white supremacist angle to it. He was a member of Aryan Nations. He was attending rallies. He was found with a copy of the Turner Diaries, which is a fictionalized novel that the white supremacist movement they use as a Bible for revolution. You know, we didn't make that connection. So we really need to understand that we already have a massive problem in our own country. And unless we start bringing opportunity to all the places that need it, it's going to continue.
All right. And lastly, I just wanted to point out that the group that you have since left to start another endeavor, Life After Hate, was had been earmarked a grant for, I think it was $400,000, maybe it was $500,000 in the last year of the Obama administration. And at a time where, you know, I'm just looking at a ProPublica piece from, I think, today or yesterday, a California man, Samuel Woodward, has been charged with murdering a 19-year-old University of Pennsylvania student, Blaise Bernstein. And apparently, Woodward is allegedly a member of the Adam Waffen Division, which is a an armed fascist group. I imagine you're somewhat aware of it. But that your group was given a grant to help get people out of this this lifestyle, I guess, or associations, and the Trump administration rescinded it upon taking office.
Yeah, that's correct. Under President Obama, Life After Hate was awarded a $400,000 grant to ramp up an already successful intervention model that we were going to take online to focus on, counter narrative and reaching people who were engaged in these groups. We were thrilled. We were the only organization that was awarded a grant that was focused on, countering white supremacy and white extremism. And we were patiently waiting for the funds to hit our account when the transition happened. And about 2 weeks after Trump took office, we were notified that even though we had won the grant, it was being rescinded and weren't given, any specific reason as to why. But we were one of, I think, only two of the, 40 organizations that won that were rescinded. And we were, in fact, the only one focused on white extremism. Had we, gotten that grant, we were already ready to hit the pavement. And perhaps this was before Charlottesville happened. Perhaps we could have, averted and reached people who'd been there, maybe even James Alex Fields, who was driving that car, who was influenced by propaganda online. Perhaps we could have, reached some of the Adam Waffen individuals who I've had contact with, some who are influenced by them here in the Chicago area. That's a really interesting case, which I think, really speaks a lot to my theory that identity and community and purpose are what drives radicalization instead of ideology, because the individual in that Adam Waffen group, one of them had switched from a neo-Nazi skinhead to kind of a radical Islamist, ended up killing one of the roommates. So, it's a really fascinating story of why young people may do some of these horrific things that we constantly are hearing about every day, whether it's a school shooting or a racist attack or, flying to Syria to join ISIS.
Christian Piccolini, the book is White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program where we will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We will also take your IMs.
Some breaking news. McCabe is stepping down.
Yes. I was just about to say, you can also, you can IM us through the app at majorityapp.com. Breaking news from NPR and from CNN, Deputy Director Andrew McCabe has told the FBI staff he's stepping down effective today. It appears that he's going to take a leave of absence. He was set to retire, I guess, in May, is it? March. And if he makes it to March, I guess, he gets his full pension. And so he's taking a leave of absence until then. Donald Trump is already tweeting about it. Of course, we will talk about that in the fun half.
What do you think about that? Do you even care?
I'm not sure. I really don't know what to make of it. I mean, he's been taking a lot of grief. And the story that the right will have you believe is that her wife was getting money directly from Hillary Clinton in a campaign run that she had. And the reality is, as I understand it, his wife ran for office and had received a donation from a group that was supportive also of Hillary Clinton, that he did not even vote in the general election, that he voted only in the Republican primary, and that the timing of the donation came, I don't know what it's supposed to indicate, but he's been under fire for an extended period of time. What the Trump administration is trying to do is to get all of those people that James Comey had kept in the loop with, concurrent with his meeting with Trump, because this is the key here. When James Comey comes out of the meeting with Trump, where Trump is like, I need your loyalty, or, the general is a good guy. Just let him, don't worry about him.
It's fine.
Yeah.
It's good.
Don't, you don't want to go after him.
His son's pretty stupid, but also okay.
Right. Comey not only kept notes, but he went and kept two or three people at the upper echelons of the FBI informed. Because, as we have learned, it's come out in like the Me Too accusations. Those accusations that are backed up by people who will testify that at the time these events supposedly happened, they were told by the person that there was a concurrent story. So it's not like I kept I didn't say anything to anybody. And a year later I said, oh, Donald Trump said this. No, the guy got out of the office and then within hours or within a day or two informed key people around him that this happened. And I am telling you this so that there is some type of concurrent testimony that I'm giving to individuals who are. And so the Trump administration is trying to make sure that all of these different people are either discredited, out of the picture, they would prefer not have a position at the FBI. Because
just what the FBI needs, another Hillary voter.
Exactly. So that's what's going on here. And I don't know if that's going to really make a difference. One thing I should tell you that we did not discuss last week on the announcement that or the reporting that Trump had wanted to fire Mueller. But Mueller can investigate that. Part of his purview is investigating anything that could be perceived as interference with his investigation. Firing him would do that.
I'm going to scope that out too, bro.
And so anybody associated, and let's put it this way. If the story is that Don McGahn was going to quit if Donald Trump fired Mueller, guess what Don McGahn is going to do now? He's going to have to test, I think. I know there's a lawyer, a client privilege, but I don't know if in this instance, McGahn can avoid testifying or answering questions from Mueller. I don't know. But know that it's within his purview to investigate that. So
who's Don McGahn?
I've never heard of him.
I never heard of that guy. I mean, you say you mention him. I never started anything with Don McGahn.
I went after him like I was in heat. All right. We got to take...
Now, that would have actually sounded a lot better.
folks, tonight...
Like I was in heat.
Because tomorrow night we're doing live State of the Union coverage, the regularly scheduled TMBS that happens on Tuesday night is actually going to be happening on Monday. That is tonight. That is magic. Who will Indeed. Be joining you tonight?
Big Waz, Wozni Lombre. Ricky Rawls, Trevor from Champagne Sharks.
There you go. So that's TMBS, 7 p.m.?
Yes, indeed.
7 p.m. on either on, you can listen via the app, at majorityapp.com, or you can check it out on YouTube at our Majority Report YouTube page. And of course, you can always... subscribe via iTunes, which you should do anyways.
Yes, that's true. And for this show, everybody should just do iTunes for everybody. It helps.
It helps. People come to the shows that way. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Where are we? What's happening with your Patreon now, Jamie?
Dropping a post later today. Check it out.
Boom.
I wish you had a hammer sound effect for that.
Ching. Bong. All right, 646-257-3920. Be right back.